Good morning, everyone. It's the top of the hour, so we do want to get started. We'd like to welcome everyone to our teleseminar that is entitled Addressing the Emotional Issues in Your Classroom. My name is Donna McGee, and I have the privilege of introducing Dr. Ruby Payne, who is our speaker for today's session, as I'm sure you are all aware. David Conrad, who is also an AHA employee, has muted everyone's line, so we just want to make you aware of that. So those are just a couple of the logistics before we get started here. I believe that probably all of you know and understand that the emotional resource is discussed in Ruby's original work, A Framework for Understanding Poverty. And the impact of emotion on both learning and behavior when working with students and parents is significant and seems to be growing even more so. This is a topic that Ruby is currently researching and doing more study and more writing on. So you are some of the first to be privy to what she's learning and her new thinking on this topic. Yesterday when you received your email with the conference call number, you should have received a handout, and I hope you all have that in front of you because Ruby will be referencing that. And before I turn the mic over to Ruby, I would like to remind you that during the call, if you think of a question, please just email us at questions@ahaprocess.com. Again, that is questions@ahaprocess.com. Ruby will be speaking probably for 35, 40 minutes, maybe a little bit longer, but then we will have an opportunity to pose these questions to her after she concludes her remarks with you. And again, I thank everybody for joining us. We know your time's valuable and limited, so I'd like to go ahead and turn the mic over to Dr. Ruby Payne for today's topic.
Good morning, and it's a pleasure to have all of you here and look at some of the issues around emotional resources, both emotional poverty and emotional wealth. As we do more and more work with in the classroom and more work transitioning adults from poverty out, what we're finding is that the lot of roadblocks, et cetera, are having to do with emotional issues that aren't articulated. And what we're finding in the classroom is that people are complaining or concerned very much more about just emotional issues, angry students, students who don't trust adults, students who have no respect for authority, students who have very little impulse control, the whole thing of just being able to stay on task. So I want to talk about two issues here, or three, as we, and then open it up for questions. But in the key point section that I typed out for you in the handouts, one of the things is that, first of all, it's emotional poverty and emotional wealth is not really a respecter of socioeconomic. There's not, what we do know is there's a correlate in the hard research between poverty and depression. But the reality is that the fewer your resources, the more taxing the emotional resources are on you. As a matter of fact, I just read a book called Emotional Intelligence 2.0, and this is building, it's a training to build emotional intelligence in adults. And one of the things they found is that people's emotional intelligence tended to go up, as the way they define it, until 2008. And then the numbers started dropping rapidly. And the thing of it is that's when the recession started. So we know that there's a correlate there. But it occurs at any age. People fluctuate depending on what external circumstances occur to individuals. But we know that the fewer the resources you have, the fewer you boundaries you have. One is you just don't have boundaries in physical space, which means that the boundaries for mental space and emotional space aren't there as well either. And the good news is they can be developed at any age. Now, one of the things I want to talk about concretized behaviors, I have a tool to give you as we're moving in on this, but concretized behaviors are behaviors that are learned. before you're 11 or 12, before you have abstract language, and they're actually recorded in the limbic system of the brain where the emotion is. And the thing is that individuals, adults and students alike, engage in those behaviors long before, almost instinctively, they're concretized. And so they're literally in there. And what the research is that if cognitive approaches alone will not change a concretized behavior. One of the things you have to do to change a habitual response to something is you have to practice the new behavior. And there's a concept called elapsed time, which I think would be wonderful for schools to use. And it's basically this idea. You know when you're making growth in behavioral change when the amount of elapsed time is reduced. In other words, I can say to you, this is a behavior that's causing you trouble, whatever it might be, okay? Well, what we know from the research is if it's a concretized behavior, you will engage in that behavior again, okay? And then sometimes it'll be a week or two afterwards and you think, oh, no, I did it again, okay? So what happens is you have simply then gone back and recognized it. Well, if you do the behavior a second time and it's only a week that has elapsed, you're getting better at recognizing the behavior. What we know is that people will often do the behavior as they recognize they're doing it. And when you can finally stop it, recognize it before you do it and stop it, that's a huge jump in your behavior growth. So it's called elapsed time, and it's a way you can know whether or not people are making actually growth and behavior change. A lot of times in the school business, we expect that we tell the kid will do it the next time. And the reality is that if it's a concretized behavior, that will not happen. Now, I get a lot of comments from people that kids are angry, and particular males. And so I need to say a little bit about males and anger and emotional response. But I will say this, that two things can calm down an angry kid almost immediately. One is to make them drink water. What happens is when they drink water, water actually metabolizes cortisol. And anger is the default emotion for males. So water will metabolize cortisol a lot faster, so they calm down. As a matter of fact, if a teacher or administrator just keeps 8-ounce bottles of water in their office or their room, and you will watch the students sit down and calm down. Number two, looking at the ceiling. If you just tell them to look at the ceiling for a while, when your eyes are in that up position, you neurologically cannot access what is stored emotionally. So what you are forced to do is calm down. So I used to say to students, look at the ceiling and draw a guitar for me or whatever it is that you need them to do. But it is actually their brains are not able to access that emotional feeling, and so you watch their bodies relax. The third thing for boys is that if you want a boy to talk to you, a male brain, the way it's hardwired, it's important to do two things. One, seat the male to your side so that in the research on males, they don't really like to discuss emotional issues looking at you. So you sit them side by side. And the second thing they do is they'll talk a lot more if there's some movement, something to do with their hands, something that way. Male brains are hardwired to see motion. Female brains are hardwired to see detail and color. One of the things a friend of mine does is he's a behavioralist specialist for a building. He'll have an angry student come in. And part of the issue is that 80% of educators are female. Well, only about 50% of the students are male. So if you look at your data, what you will see is that 80% of the data across the U.S. is that 80% of high school dropouts are male. A majority of kids in special ed are male. The majority of discipline referrals are male. The majority of non-readers are male. And one of the things we know is that for males to be successful in learning, they have to have movement in particular. So a friend of mine who's a behavior specialist, he does this. He'll have an angry boy in his office, and what he'll do is he keeps a tennis ball in his office that he will start bouncing. Now, what we know is that once the heartbeat gets over 165 beats a minute, the ability of the brain to control abstract reasoning is actually gone. So you can't talk. So what he'll do is he'll give the child a water to drink, and he'll start bouncing the tennis ball while he's sitting across the room, but in a kind of a horizontal line to the student. He'll start bouncing that ball, and what he'll do is he'll slow down the bouncing, okay, because it'll slow down the heartbeat of the student, okay? There's a rhythmic piece there. And then what he'll say after the boys drank the water, he'll say, look, I'm going to bounce the ball to you once. You catch it. You bounce it back to me once. This office isn't very big. He'll do this 3 or 4 times, and then he'll say to the student, okay, what happened? And the kid will start talking while they're bouncing the ball. And it's a much faster way to get responses out of students. Now, when the behavior is concretized, okay, the problem is simply that they're not going to have, A, the language for it, and, 2, they're not going to understand the response, their physical response that startles even them, and, 3, they're not going to be able to change that behavior unless there's some practice. Now, one of the things that the brain naturally does as part of its search thing, because it's based on survival, is it naturally searches for negatives first. One of the problems when you come out of poverty is you're fear-based and survival-based anyway. Okay, so the problem is the negative tends to be a much more powerful motivator in terms of what they say to themselves. However, to do a task, what the brain requires is positive self-talk. So there's a tool you can give to kids called if-then. And one of the things that you do with if-then is this. You find something they can already do, okay? Because if you just tell a kid, do it, do it, do it, they can't do it, okay? But if you say this to them, okay, find something they can already do, and then you say, if you can do this, then you can do this. Let me give you an example. I was working with these 3 high school boys in Baytown that failed the exit level test 3 times, and so I gave them a quiz or a skills test. They all had the skills. So I said to the boys, did you all quit in the test? And they said yes. I said, what did you say to yourself when you quit? And the first boy said, well, this is stupid. This is dumb. I quit. The second boy said, well, Ray, it's too many. I said, how many did you miss? He said, 5. I said, how many can you miss? He said, I don't know. I said, you could miss 25. And I said, the third boy, what happened for you? He said, well, I was working at a fast food place. I didn't get home till 1. He said, I was miserably tired, so I just laid down my head and quit. So I said to the boys, you know what? You don't have any positive self-talk. You don't have any way to talk yourself through a task, and all successful people do that. I said, so do all of you boys have a driver's license? They said, yes. I said, well, getting a driver's license is much harder than this test, because not only do you have to take a paper-pencil test, you have to demonstrate you can do it. I said, on this test, all you have to do is take a paper-pencil test. So I said, what I want you to say to yourself, and we're going to practice it now, if I can get a driver's license, then I can pass this test. So you find something they can already do to begin the behavior. Now, one of the things about angry students, if a student is angry and they don't have a biochemical issue, then they've been betrayed by an adult. One of the things that school people want students to do right away is trust them. And what I'm going to recommend that you tell a student right off the bat is, look, you know what? You have no reason to trust me. You don't know me, okay? And so all I can tell you is that I don't expect you to trust me for a while, if ever. But I will tell you this. I care about you. I'm going to do everything I can to help you win in this class. But I think you need to wait to decide about trusting me for a while until you're more comfortable with what you see how I am. What you're doing is just by the very notion of giving them permission not to trust, okay, what you do then is you allow them then to have a more open relationship with you simply because you gave them the right not to trust them. Now, one of the things we know is that more and more schools are dealing with students who have what is called an anxiety-based disorder. Now, let me say about anxiety. Anxiety occurs when the expectations aren't met. If you look, and anxiety is about what if, while insight is about what is. And one of the things we know is that all of us, and part of the dynamic I want to explain here is the dynamic that occurs in a classroom between the emotional needs of the teacher and the emotional needs of the students, okay? Everybody, every human being has a set of expectations, and this is number 12 on your key points, about four things: prerogatives, pleasure, power, and privilege. We all have a set of expectations around those, okay? And what they all help us do is anticipate safety, and safety is built on two things. In the research on safety, safety is about predictability and trust, okay? So one of the things that happens is that for there to be a concept of safety, people need to have predictability and trust, okay? Well, what we do is we set up around these expectations a set of anticipations about how things will be, okay? When we get those, then we're satisfied and happy. When we don't, then we go to anxiety, and anxiety produces over time a set of behaviors people engage in to satiate themselves. So in other words, to satiate their anxieties. It might be eating. It might be drugs. It might be risk-taking. It might be anger. It might be shopping. It might be gambling. It might be any kind of behavior that will satiate our anxiety. It might be procrastination. It could be anything, depending on the human being. Well, what happens is you have a classroom teacher, you have an administrator with a set of anticipations, expectations. You have students, 25, 30 students in there with a different set. And one of the things that we're looking at is how those two marry. Okay? In other words, we know that 80% of the discipline referrals come from 11% of the staff. And we know that 90% of discipline referrals come from 10% of the kids. What we also know is this, is that bonding and attachment occur before you're 6 years old. So by the primary caregiver. Now, there's four styles of bonding and attachment, but one style in particular, they're around whether you see yourselves emotionally secure or not. Okay, one of the styles is one in which you're emotionally insecure and you're emotionally disorganized because you've had a caregiver who in the research was typically a young mother, okay? And so what happens is you have no internal boundaries at all, okay? And what you see, the styles are based upon a quadrant. I'm good. The world is good. I'm bad. The world is bad. Well, what happens in that last quadrant where you're insecure and disorganized, you see yourself as bad and the world is bad in a dangerous place. So it's survival of the fittest. There are no rules. You do what you want to do. Well, what we're finding in the classroom, in particular in kindergarten and first and second grade now, we're getting more and more students who are coming in that last quadrant. Okay, I'm bad, the world's bad, there is no secure place, it's the survival of the fittest, I'm going to do what I need to do. What has to happen in the school is the school must do a behavioral approach of practicing behaviors to concretize the appropriate behaviors for school. In other words, you have to teach the boundaries and the structures that will help you do school. What we're finding right now is a lot of these kids are getting placed in alternative placement, okay? The thing is that you have until about 4 or 5 years to concretize in the behaviors that you need to respond to the environment of school. school. So it's a critical time frame in there where behaviors can be taught and practiced to concretize them in for that environment, okay? And one of the things I'll just say at kindergarten that we recommend is that you give each kid a stuffed animal. And one of the things they do is that that's their animal, and every morning when they come in, they tell their animal what they have to do for the day in kindergarten, how they have to behave. What you are doing is you're concretizing in with a stuffed animal the appropriate, the internal self-talk for the appropriate behaviors. Now, I want to talk about this whole grid on, and we enclosed a checklist for you that you can use for adults and kids, but it's a look at your own emotional responses, okay? And I have to tell you quite candidly, there's some things on here I can't check very often, okay? But the last one I want to look with you at is that very last page on the Cartman Triangle. And I want to give you a tool here to deal with with bullying, with victimization, with manipulative parents, with manipulation in the workplace. It's brilliant. It's a piece of work that was done in 1960 by a man named Cartman, and it's called the Cartman Triangle. And basically what he says is this, that there are, this triangle has three parts to it, a victim, a rescuer, and an abuser, a persecutor, a bully, okay? Now, what we know, and if you want to write it on this sheet, is basically what we know, number one, the fewer the resources in any setting, the workplace, the home, wherever, the fewer the resources, the more people will engage in this triangle. And number two, the only way to avoid the triangle is to stay out of it by asking questions. And number three, once you get in the triangle, you will take on all three roles at some point in time. Let me give you a couple examples. And let me say number four before we go on. And number four, I recommend that when you have this going on with a student or a teacher or administrator or a parent, draw the triangle out for them and show them what they're doing, because it's a powerful mental model. But let me give you an example. My son, when he was in the second grade, he came home from school one day, and he said, "Mom, I'm bored." Okay? Now, the underlying thing there was is that he portrayed himself as a victim, and he wanted me to go to school and rescue him. And the way I was going to supposedly rescue him was bully the teacher. Okay? Well, I instead stayed out of the triangle by asking him questions. I said, "Tommy," I said, "is the teacher bored?" And he said, "No, I am." I said, no, the first question I asked him was this. I said, "Tommy, whose problem is that?" He said, "The teacher's." I said, "Tom, is the teacher bored?" He said, "No." Then I said, "Well, then it's not the teacher's problem, is it?" I said, "Whose problem is it?" He said, "It's mine." I said, "That's right, sweetie." I said, "So it could be a problem for you all your life. So let's talk about what are the solutions you can do so that you will never be bored in your whole life. Let's make a list of things you can do at school when you get done early that you could work on or do that you would like to do." I said, "Do you like to read?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, let's make sure you have some books." I said, "What else can you do? Are you allowed to draw?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Are there allowed other activities you're allowed to do?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, let's do those things then." But what happens in the school business with a bully is we handle bullies typically very badly, because when a bully bullies another kid, we bully the bully, okay? And then we tell them, "Don't you dare do that again," okay? Well, what happens is the parent comes in then, because the child comes home, presents themselves as a victim, the parent comes in to rescue their child and then bullies the principal. Well, you know. Well, the thing is, you just have to stay out of that whole triangle. What you say to a student when they're bullying another student is you ask them this question: where in your life don't you feel safe? because the hard research is that at the top of the social pecking order and at the bottom of the social pecking order, those kids don't bully. So the issue is that there's a safety factor in the social pecking order, and that's what the bullying is about, okay? And so part of the issue is emotional kind of thing. Like I had a father come in when I was a principal, and he said to me, he said, Kate, his fourth grade daughter, is being sexually harassed by Brandon. He said, I want you to ensure to me that Brandon will never be within speaking distance of my daughter again. I said, well, Kate's beautiful. I said, and I said, Brandon has rights as well. I said, but I need to ask you a question. I said, the sexual harassment research is that the harassed must tell the harasser they don't like it. I said, so what is Kate saying to Brandon when he does these things? And he said, well, I don't know. So we called Kate in. I said, Kate, what do you say when he does this? And Kate said, I just smile, okay? Well, I thought her dad was going to kill her. I said, honey, you have to tell Brandon you don't like it. He doesn't know. You must tell him that. She said, well, I can't do that. And her dad said, yes, you can. So I sent her back to her classroom, and I said to the father, look, I will deal with Brandon. I said, but the reality is that Kate is beautiful, and she's going to have unwanted sexual advances all her life. And I said, you're not going to be with her every time. When she's in high school, she's out on a date, there's a possibility of date rape. I said, don't you think we ought to give her the tools right now so that when she is at those ages where you're not with her, that she can defend herself and be safe? He said, absolutely. I said, well, I agree. And I said, I'm also going to work with Brandon. I said, but we need to keep Kate safe, no matter where she is, no matter what age she is. That's an example of how you stay out of that triangle, okay? I have a friend who's a principal, and he had a staff member come in and say to him, I want you to talk to so-and-so, another staff member, because they're doing this and this and this to me. All right, the staff member's portraying themselves as a victim. They want to be rescued by the principal. They're portraying this other staff member as an abuser, a persecutor, bully. And so my friend, the principal, said, well, you know what? I appreciate that you've come to talk to me about this. He said, for us to resolve this issue, both you and the other person have to be in the room together, and we have to work on it together and talk it through. Well, what he did is he stayed out of the triangle by discussing the issues. So one of the tools I'm going to give you today is this whole concept of how you then stay out of this triangle so that you begin to, among your staff. And one of the things you'll have in discipline issues for that 11% of your staff who creates 80% of the referrals, they often present themselves as a victim, or they come across as a bully. When they send a student to the office, they want to be rescued from that student. And so the issue is then, it's also tied to voices, okay? One of the things we find is that if you stay in the adult voice, if you ask questions, you can also stay out of the triangle, and it really reduces the amount of bullying, victimization at all levels of the organization. I'm going to stop there now, and I'll just say I am working on a book. I got it half done, but on how you address emotional issues in the classroom very quickly, because nobody's going to have time to do a full-blown-out counseling session in the classroom, okay? But there are a lot of tools out there that are fairly quick that can help you address some of the issues. So let's open it up to questions now.
Okay, again, that email address if you will send them to questions@ahaprocess.com. I think that will be the best way since we have about 250 people on the call, and if we unmuted the lines, that could be challenging to not be speaking over one another.
Wow. No questions? Must have been crystal clear. No, really. Are there questions?
David, you don't have any yet, do you?
No, if Amanda has not forwarded any, then none have come in yet. So if you'd like to speak on another topic for a few minutes, Ruby, I think we'll probably get some now that people know that there's a dearth.
Another question?
Uh-huh.
Okay. One of the most interesting parts that I'm working on right now in this emotional issue is the story that people carry about themselves around in their head. One of the things we know is that identity is linked almost totally into the story you carry around about yourself in your head. And one of the things we know from those stories is that a future story, they can intersect with the story in your head and shift it. But what we find happens is if the story tends to be developed in your head by the time you're 12, when your brain is still concretized. So what we know is that a lot of students carry story, and adults for that matter, everybody, carries a story around inside their head about themselves that may be counterproductive for their success in the current environment they're in, and they don't know it. And one of the most interesting things is to how you begin to access that story and anxieties as you make changes it not only in your adolescent life, but in your adult life. One of the things we know, for example, is in the difference between male and female brains, what we know is that male brains are much more compartmentalized than female brains. When you have an emotional hit in a female brain, in the MRI brain scans, and this would be for 90% of females, okay? 10% of any population is aberrant. They're just not going to, 6 to 10% of any population by aberrant. I mean, they just don't fit the norms, okay? But 90% of females, when they have an emotional hit in their brain, the whole brain is flooded with that information within 2-3 minutes. When a male has an emotional hit in the brain, it's kind of in the base of their skull. And in the MRI brain research, it takes on the average 5 hours before that emotional information gets through the head. Furthermore, the way male brains are constructed in compartmentalization, they like to examine one thing at a time. In other words, they're not going to multi-mix, I guess, would be the word I want to use, like females do in their brain. Like, because females process so much more, the female brain at the emotional level, one of the things that emotions do is they hardwired into the brain memory faster. And so what we know is that when this happens, you will then react much more quickly. One of the most interesting things is, and one of the things I've been doing a lot of work around, is the emotional responses of males in the school, because we are losing so many males. And because 80% of the staff tends to be female, there's a total misunderstanding often about how a male will process emotionally. And number two, what emotional significance they will assign to something. And number three, the whole way that they will then process and compartmentalize the information. So one of the things that happens when men get stressed or males get stressed, they go to that part of the brain that is, as one person calls it, their nothing box. In other words, it's where there's nothing there. In fact, the University of Pennsylvania did hard research on male brains, and they found they actually have the capability of doing, the brain does, of having no activity and still breathe. And so one of the things is that what happens when a male gets stressed emotionally or stressed by the environment, they go to that nothing box and they basically don't do anything and they don't perform. Well, what we do a lot in the school business is we penalize males for being in that box. What happens for females is when females get stressed, all they want to do is talk. When a male gets stressed, their default emotion is anger. When a female gets stressed, they tend to cry. What happens in the school business is if a girl cries or talks out her emotion, we don't discipline them negatively for that. We usually comfort them. But when a male doesn't want to talk, goes to their nothing box, refuses to do anything, and gets angry, then we discipline them for that. When in actuality, that is a natural male hardwired response. So one of the key issues is, what do you do with a male when that's their response? And one of the things that they need is just time, okay? So you give them the water. One principal I know did this. She had a set of headphones with some music on it that she put on them, and they sat that way for 5, 10 minutes before then, and they drank some water before she attempted to even address the issue. Second thing is that males will then, as I said earlier, they'll talk more if there's movement and if they're doing something. So part of what happens is how male and females respond to stress is so very different, and it is part of this whole response pattern as well.
Okay, Ruby, we have questions if you're ready.
I'm ready.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The first one deals with the Carpenter triangle. You mentioned 4 points related to that. Could you review the third point?
To stay out of the triangle? Was the third point about staying out of the triangle?
I had written down that the third point was that once you get in the triangle, you'll take on all three roles.
See, what happens is this. Let's use the bully example, okay? You have a kid who's a bully. So the principal or the teacher pulls the bully in, and they bully the bully. So the first role they take on is the bully. They say to the bully, "Don't you dare do that anymore in my classroom." Okay, now the bully becomes the victim. Typically, the parent comes in to rescue the child, and when the parent comes in, they bully the teacher, and then the teacher feels like a victim. So it goes round and round. See, at one point, the bully was the bully. Now the bully's the victim because he's being bullied by the teacher, but the victim is going to go home and get his parent to rescue him. Do you see how that works? So the triangle never stops. So the only way to stay out of the triangle is not to get in it and to ask questions. A friend of mine who's a minister, he told me this story because I showed him this Cartman triangle as a way he could explain to his vestry why they should not retaliate. What happened is they had a set of members in the church who got mad, who were quite unreasonable in their anger about the way an issue was addressed in which they wanted it to be addressed differently. So what these two parishioners, husband and wife, did is they sent a letter to the bishop about the minister. So in other words, they bullied, okay, they made the minister the victim. The two parishioners bullied the minister, and they sent a letter to the bishop to be rescued. Well, what happened? Because they wanted the minister punished, okay? They wanted the bishop to bully the minister. What happened was that the vestry was furious at this, so the vestry wanted to send a letter to the two parishioners and bully them. But they couldn't do that in this church. And the minister told his vestry, no, we don't, the priest told his vestry, we don't want to do that. He couldn't get them to understand why. So I showed him the Cartman triangle, and I said, you need this to show this to your vestry. Then they will understand why they don't want to get in that triangle, because it's not going to solve any problems for them. They're just going to switch roles, and it's not going to be any different than what their members are doing already. So stay out of it. It's not going to help you solve that problem.
Okay, thanks, Ruby. Another one, could you provide a couple of conversation starters that would help teachers stay out of the triangle in the classroom?
Okay. One of the things I would say is, first of all, the first thing I would do for teachers is draw them this triangle, okay, and say, this is why you want to stay out of this in the classroom, okay? And then here are questions that I recommend they use, okay? And there's something in the psychological research called invitational language, okay? Invitational language is when you use words and phrases that invite people to participate without mandating it. Like, for example, one of the invitational phrases is this, I wonder, W-O-N-D-E-R. I wonder what would happen if, okay? I wonder what the thinking was when this occurred, okay? I wonder how that made you feel. I wonder, and the second piece of advice about questions is you never ask the question why. Why puts people on the defensive? So you would ask what, when, where, or how questions. Okay, how a question I used to ask kids a lot is, how's that working for you? Okay, or I'd ask this question, when you did that, what did you want? Okay, or I would ask a parent this question, if you were king or queen of the world, how would you like to see this problem solved, okay? Those are all invitational language. That's all invitational language. And so what you're doing is encouraging them to participate. The third tip I would give teachers is this. Teachers like to, educators, not just teachers, administrators, teachers, educators like to ask motivation questions. Why did you do that, you know? Give it up. We need to do what law enforcement does. And law enforcement asks procedural questions. So in other words, if they want to stay out of the triangle, the first question I would ask a student is this. I'd say, now, what was the first thing that you did? Okay? And so I would say, what's the first thing you saw? What's the first thing that happened? And then what happened next? And how did you think about that? Or how did you feel about that? And what you're running them through is procedural language and procedural. So it stays, again, procedural talk, any of those question stems I talked about, the invitational language. The fourth thing I'll do sometimes to drill down deeper, particularly if I'm working with an adult, I'll use one of those four question words, what, when, how, to what extent, but I'll put the word specifically in front of it, okay? Because one of the things that kids will do, one of the things adults will do, is they'll do what I call generalized language. They'll say, everybody's doing it, or everybody knows, or you're not ever fair, or you hate me because of who I am, or you don't like me. And what you say then is you just say, because see, when a kid comes and says, you don't like me, they are presenting themselves as a victim. And so they're bullying you, okay? And so what I just say to them is, specifically, can you tell me a time when I was not fair? And if they get mad about that, I'll just say, look, I need to understand this, so please help me with this, okay? Help me understand is another invitational phrase. Another invitational phrase is, another one is, if you were me, how would you solve this problem? Because I want to know if they're thinking about it. Another invitational phrase you can use to get a lot of information about somebody, about themselves, is to say, well, you know, like if a kid comes to you and says, well, nobody in my family likes me. And so I might ask, well, what would your sister say about you? Okay? And then let them give you conversation about that. That's invitational language. What do you think your sister would say about you, or your mother, or your father? Because basically what they're actually telling you when you ask them that question, they're askingly telling you how they perceive themselves. So whatever voice is strong there, that's the information they're giving you. It's invitational language. Another phrase that's invitational language is, you may see. You might see. You might know about this in a way I don't. It's invitational language. And so you're giving them an opportunity to respond.
Okay, thank you, Ruby. We have about six or seven other ones here.
Okay.
The next one is, would you cover the quadrant again?
Oh, the bonding attachment quadrant?
Right.
Okay. If you make a quadrant on a piece of paper, I didn't attach this because I didn't put it in here, but if you make a quadrant on a piece of paper, what you will get is this. Okay, across the top of the quadrant, in the first box, is a plus, and that means that's a positive me, okay? The second quadrant across the top, horizontal, is a negative me, okay? In other words, I'm bad, but the world, okay, I'm bad, okay? The first box, I'm good. The second box, I'm bad, okay? Then in the second row of the quadrant, okay, what you have is the way you view the world. And the first box in across the vertical side of the quadrant is the world. So in the first row of boxes, a plus is I think the world is positive, I think the world is negative. I think the world is positive. So, in other words, let's go across that first quadrant. Okay? The first box in the left-hand side is a positive me and a positive world. I think I'm a good person. I think the world's a good person. And I am emotionally secure. Now, keep in mind, this is research that was done about attachment and bonding styles. And actually, those of you that deal with middle and high school kids, these are attachment and bonding styles show up in romantic relationships the rest of your life, okay, unless you have some intervention. So, and part of the way you respond to bullying is whether or not what your attachment and bonding style is, okay? In the second box across the top, I think the world is a positive place, but I'm not any good. So like a black sheep of a family, okay? I'm no good, but the world is good. So that would be anxious and insecure. So that emotional style is insecure, and I'm anxious. So that's the kid who always comes up to your desk and says, is this right? Did I do this right? Is this right? One of my friends told me about a teacher they have, a new teacher, and the teacher's classroom is just out of control. And when they spoke to the new teacher about it, the teacher said, look, I'm a good person, the kids are bad, which is the next style I want to talk about. If you go to the second row of boxes, the third, it would be I'm a positive me, but the world is a negative place. That's what this teacher was telling her supervisor. I'm okay, but the world's bad. And so that makes me, at an emotional level, avoidant and insecure. So I'm not sure about who I am, but I'm going to avoid any situations that emotionally make me uncomfortable, okay? So I don't like any situation that's not to my liking. I just won't participate. The last box is, in the lower right-hand corner, is a negative world and a negative me. I'm bad and the world is bad. And that makes you insecure and disorganized. And it's the student I was talking about right now that we're having the greatest deal of difficulty with in terms of behavior, because they don't have any the only concrete ties behaviors they have are the ones in which I'm going to win at any cost, I'm going to do what I want to do, there are no boundaries, and I'm going to not observe any because the world's a bad place and I'm a bad person. And so one of the things that happens is that if you have a teacher, for example, or an administrator, for example, who has a positive me and a positive world, then they're fairly secure in their position, okay? You have an administrator who's negative, I don't feel very good about myself, but I think the world's a good place to be, then they're going to be really anxious about if they're doing a good job, okay, particularly a new teacher. They want to, oh, is this right? Did I do this right? And if a staff member comes to them and says, you did this wrong, you better not do it that way again, then they're going to change. In fact, one of the things I had to do when I was a principal, I had two staff bullies, two faculty bullies. And one of the things I did was I made sure I protected my new teachers from that by always talking to the teachers about what they were doing and encouraging them to continue in that path if it was a good path, okay? What happens in the negative world, but a positive me, is if there's a situation in their classroom that's going on, and I'm talking about a beginning teacher, they're not going to come tell you about it, because they're going to avoid anything that's emotionally uncomfortable, okay? And besides, it's not their fault, okay? So what happens then, and my guess is you wouldn't have teachers who were negative me, negative world. Very few of those would show up, mostly because they would have to learn a certain level of norms before they could even get through college. But the bottom line on the thing is that as you begin working with it, and you will have parents in those quadrants as well, I'll never forget, I had more than one parent when I was a principal who would come in, and they were so anxious and insecure. You know, I know that the world's a good place, but I'm just not very capable, and I'm not very good, and can you help me? They were so anxious and insecure about being a parent, and always constantly looking for support and help.
Okay, thanks, Ruby. Here's another one for you. You've helped us understand a lot about the emotional issues and why they occur, but can you give a few tips for actually handling them quickly in the classroom? How do we deal with them?
Well, I thought I did. But let me go through some of them again, okay? One is the water. One is the looking at the ceiling. One is making sure that your classroom is structured with very clear guidelines and roles. One is keeping staying out of the Cartman triangle. One is to use the invitational language. One is to, and I didn't talk about this one, but together, you have to set up relationships and mutual respect with your students in that classroom. And it's not about being their friend. It's about saying, these are the parameters of the room, and this is how we're going to operate in here. And so one of the things that we do on that is we make sure that we're clear. Like I used to say this to kids, teaching and learning is a two-way street. You're on that street, I'm on that street. There's things you got to do, there's things I got to do, okay? You have a right to be safe and free in this classroom, free of comment, but I have a right to insist on behaviors that make it that way. You have a right to know why you're getting any assignment and why we're doing that. And if I can't explain it to you, you ought to be able to, we shouldn't do it. On the other hand, I have the right to ask you to do it. You have the right to know how your assignment's going to be graded before you get it, but I, on the other hand, have a right to have you to do your own work. You have the right to, get extra help, but I have a right to you to tell me that because I don't always understand it. And then I know that you need it. And then I'd say this to them, okay? You're not going to like me every day, and I'm not going to like you every day. And that's okay because some days I don't even like me, okay? But I care about you, and I'm really wanting the following things for you by the end of the year, and I'm really going to insist upon that. So you're setting up. A lot of these things are very quick questions you might ask a student. It's your nonverbals that are judgmental. Nonverbals come from intent. If your intent is to judge it versus understand it, your student's going to pick that up right away. The other thing, though, is they know that there's a level of respect in the classroom, that you've got expectations from them. So all of these tools are there. One of the things that would be helpful to me, if you, because like I said at the beginning of this, I thought I gave tips, but obviously they weren't direct enough or clean enough. So one of the things that would help me a lot when this seminar is over, as I'm finishing up this book and working on a rough draft of it, is if you would send me the kinds of questions that you would like to have clarified, or that you'd like to have more information on, or that you'd like to have answers for. Like there's a whole nother technique out there called EFT, Emotional Freedom Technique. It's a tapping technique that you can teach kids in their classroom. It operates off the Chinese meridian system of acupuncture. And you can tap it. You can't do any damage to the kid. The kid can, but it reduces anxieties. It reduces anger. It reduces habitual responses. It's a very, and it doesn't cost anything. All you have to do is teach kids how to tap to change their energies to be more productive. And you don't even have to articulate to the kids what you're doing. All you have to say to them is, we're going to do this calming technique now, and you tap on top of your eyebrows, you tap on top by your eyes, et cetera. And the bottom line is, it's called Emotional Freedom Technique. You can look it up on Amazon.com, but the issue in the whole thing, it's a quick and dirty system to readjust energy patterns. Everything in your body is either energetic, it's either electrical or chemical. And what happened in the U.S. medical system in the early 1900s is the American Medical Association decided to go after the chemical end of it with pharmaceuticals, and never really progressed on the energy end, except to do pacemakers, which operate off electrical impulses, and brain scans, which operate off the electrical impulses in brains. But we never saw it as an interventive medicine. The Chinese, meanwhile, and the Asians kept the energetic system of acupuncture, et cetera. What we know is a lot of emotional dysfunction has to do with disrupted energy systems as well as chemical systems. And this is a very simple technique that can be used. But it would help me a great deal if you would send additional questions that you have, because one of the things my staff will tell me all the time is, Ruby, it's clear in your head, but it ain't clear in anybody else's head. So,
Ruby, another one. Can you talk briefly about the correlation that you see between poverty and the emotional deficit in students?
Okay. One of the things we know is that what happens in poverty is that, A, there are fewer resources. So the fewer the resources, the less opportunity you have to get your needs met. One of the things they'll say in dysfunctional systems is that a system is dysfunctional when you cannot get your own needs met. Well, all systems to a certain extent are dysfunctional. Everybody is. But the reality is, if you can't get your needs met, but it's actually incredibly damaging when you must have your needs sublimated to meet the needs of somebody else, as in sexual abuse. Okay. And so what happens then is that because a lot of those behaviors get concretized before you're 10, 11, 12, and because the bonding attachment thing is so critical before you're the age of 6, what happens is that when you are at survival, those things simply don't get developed. And everything becomes quid pro quo. Like, one of the things I'm debating about putting in the book or not is about the emotional cycle that happens in abuse. What happens is, we're all real familiar with what happens in abuse physically. But very few people know about the emotional cycle that occurs in abuse. And one of the reasons it's so repetitive is because it feels right. Whatever feels right emotionally, and if that feeling was concretized before you were 12, 10, 11, 12, which most of the time it is in poverty, then the bottom line is you don't even know you're participating in that emotional cycle. What happens then is that you are then, as part of that, forced into survival. What happens in survival is that you react, you don't respond. Number two, you don't have the language to talk about feelings. Talking about feelings is a luxury. It means, A, you have time to concentrate on it. And it means, B, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you actually had your other needs met. If you are hungry, you're not going to think about why you're angry. You're going to know, okay? And so what happens then is that that doesn't happen. Number three, the language to talk about your feelings is not there. It's not respected in poverty. You're a wimp if you can't handle things. And you don't talk about it, and you, for God's sake, don't cry about it, because that means you're not tough enough for the environment, okay? But it will be okay to self-medicate. And number four, the next thing that poverty does to it is there's lots and lots of death in poverty. And death is a form of betrayal, always, always, always. And what we know is that betrayals occur through death. They occur through addiction. They occur through absences. They occur through illness. They occur through mental illness. There's many, many ways to be betrayed. And what happens then, because in the research only 3% of middle class is mentally ill, in the research 7% of people in poverty are mentally ill, there's a disproportionate amount of it. Now, one of the things I want to be very careful about is this. There's an equal amount of addiction in middle class and in wealth as in poverty. But the issue is that the resources to address it are not there in poverty. Number two on this addiction issue is middle class prefers legalized pharmaceuticals. Okay, so one of the things we do in America is we make a distinction between illegal and legal drugs. That's a moot point. And in wealth, what you do is, in addition to alcohol, et cetera, and designer drugs, et cetera, you have the resource base to continue your addiction, okay, without significant impact to other people. And often, if the primary caregiver is incapacitated by addiction, there is a nanny or a replacement adult. In poverty, if the primary caregiver is incapacitated, there's no replacement adult often, and the child becomes the adult.
Okay, Ruby. We'll do a couple more here, if you're okay.
Okay.
One is, how would you use this information to help teachers, particularly teachers in Title I schools who deal with students who have a lot of emotional needs themselves? How do you help those teachers from becoming burned out?
Well, that's a very important question. And I worked with a staff in Illinois who, it was a school that was 95% low income, 45% of their students had at least one parent incarcerated. And on top of that, the school district, and I have no idea why they did this, the school district put the medical fragile unit of the district in that particular building. So they had students in that building who could die at any minute. They were that fragile. The staff was burned out. They were grieving. And what happens when people burn out and grieving is that the emotional response is no longer there. In order to survive yourself, what you have to do is you have to be hard and calloused yourself, because you can no longer absorb the grief. So what we did with that staff was, one, we talked where they were through. We used the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, the four, five stages people go through. We talked about, we gave them some tools to identify where they were in that stage. Then we had them list what they grieved the most about for kids, okay? And then what they had done to respond to it. And then we put in, like, we had teachers who were giving up their lunch every day for kids. We had kids who were, we had teachers who were buying clothes for kids. They were burnt out. And so one of the things, there's three or four things we recommend. Number one, we recommend that the district build in a three-year rotation cycle. That where I was in Barrington, Illinois, we had a high, high poverty school, and one of the things the districts did was build in a three-year rotation cycle. The understanding was that people would be in that building, but they would have a 3 years in that building. They would rotate out. The second thing we recommend is this, that we did for this faculty I worked with in Illinois, that we got together a group of churches who agreed to donate food, but they only donated two kinds of food. They donated cans of beans, like pinto beans, black beans, cans of tuna or packs of tuna. And the reason is this. It was something that the kid could put in the backpack, and I really like those foil packets of tuna because you can open them without a can opener. Both of them could be eaten cold, and number three, they could be hid in a backpack, so the kid got that. And protein is metabolized in the brain much longer than anything else and keeps you from being hungry much longer. And so what we did is we had high-protein foods. Beans are very high in protein. Another thing you can give to kids is peanut butter, because peanut butter is very high in protein if the kid doesn't have a peanut allergy, okay? And so what happened is that the kids had the right to go, if they were hungry and the teachers knew pretty much who they were, they could go and get one item out of that food pantry to take home at night if they needed it, okay? So that was a way to alleviate the huge concern about food. And since they were all on free and reduced lunch and got breakfast and lunch, the issue was night. And then that school was also looking at the possibility of weekend food packs. Now, I know that a lot of schools do that for their kids. So this is a way to not grieve for them. A third thing you can do is provide like a shower or a – we had a girl in Baytown. She came to school absolutely filthy all the time. And this little girl was a second grader and lived in a house with a dirt floor, no running water. So she would come to school. One of the aides would walk her over to the middle school, which is less than a block away. The girl took a shower and then came back. They had clean clothes for her to trade in and out of at the school. There's ways to deal with the grieving thing on the food and extreme dirtiness, filthiness, okay? The next thing I recommend is that teachers understand that their job is not to fix the child, okay? That's one of the big grieving things that middle class does. They think they need to fix everything. And what I've said to staff is this, that's not your job. And when you try and fix everything for the child, you also then teach the child that they can't solve their own problems. So what I used to say to students is this, I used to say, I really respect that you can handle situations that are tough. I'm not sure I could, but I can't change it for you. So what I can do is give you the tools and the knowledge and skill so you don't have to live this way all your life if you don't want to. And if you want me to, I'll do that. And so those are all tools that can be used. And then the staff also has to acknowledge where they are in the grieving. And I did that circle of concern with them that Covey has. I don't know if you know about that circle of concern, but the inside circle is what you can do something about. The outside circle is all the things that concern you. And what we say is this. The inside circle is the only thing you can do anything about. So let's list what you can do about. And what you can't do about, then you've got to let that go.
Okay. Ruby, I know
you know what,
we've
I got time for one more.
Okay.
The 12:30 meeting, yeah.
Okay, that's what I knew you had a schedule. Let's just give you one last one. Again, we're talking about boys, particularly African-American males. The question is, what can we do to engage them and make them more inclusive in the curriculum? During a discussion, an administrator stated she was exhausted from having to do a dog and pony show to keep African-American males engaged, such as rapping vocabulary, rapping multiplication facts. What would you say to this administrator?
Well, what I really recommend? I recommend that you bring in, that the district bring in Dr. Rita Pearson. Rita's PhD was in working with African-American males and their cognitive learning. And Rita does workshop for schools on how you interact with and work with African-American boys specifically. And Rita is African-American. And we have heard so many positive comments about all the positive things she has had to say about that. But let me just say this about males yet that I did not say earlier that I would use also. The research is that males' brains are hardwired for competition and risk-taking. If you make your learning activities competition-based, okay, with males, they will learn more. For example, I know this middle school teacher that did this. What he did was he made a football field on his wall of his classroom, and he put number two, let me go back to this. If you're from poverty or if you're under-resourced and you're male, you are not going to participate in a learning environment that's autonomous and competitive. You won't do it. You're only going to participate in a learning environment that's relational and social. So one of the things this teacher did, he put his kids in groups, and one of the things they did then was they were each a football team, and there was footballs up there on the wall. Each of them gave their team a name. So there were no more than three kids in a group, okay? Four kids, you start getting dropouts. So there were three kids in a group, and they had a team. And then he had on his wall the list of the things that gained them yards. These were good behaviors that they could gain yards with their football. There was a list of things that they lost yards, okay? There were a list of things they could do that would get them touchdowns, okay? And then every week, I believe, the team that got, and it wasn't exclusive. I mean, more than one team could have a touchdown, okay? But the team that had the touchdowns, the top two or three, whatever, they got a reward. I don't know what it was. It was lunch with the principal or extra time on the computer or something. I don't remember. Coupons to McDonald's, whatever. But the bottom line was it was a competitive environment, and it was a group activity. The second thing I'll say about it is this, is one of the reasons teachers don't like to put males in groups to work together is the research is it takes them much longer to get organized. And the reason is they have to figure out who the alpha male is. Whoever the alpha male is at 6 in the hard research is the alpha male at 15. So one of the things emotionally is that's part of the dynamic. So I would say, one, make more learning things competitive. Number two, get Rita in to give really good, strong suggestions about the best ways to approach that audience.
Well, that's great, Ruby. We thank you for...
I thank them for listening.
Well, absolutely. We appreciate everybody being with us today. And, again, Ruby has extended that invitation that if you've got points that you'd like to be clarified or questions that perhaps she could address in this book, please just use the questions at ahaprocess.com as the way to send those in. It's about 15 minutes after the hour again, so we'll wrap it up. And again, thank you, and everybody have a great day.